Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, "Till I find the righteous one, computer blue." I'm Joe McCormick.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum, and our usual host, Jonathan Strickland, is not in today. He is on a fabulous vacation. However, like the head of a hydra, we have spawned two co-hosts in his place.
Right.
Allow us to introduce to you Mr. Benjamin Bolin and Mr. Scott Benjamin of the show Car Stuff.
Our esteemed colleagues.
Yes.
Can you guys introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about what you do?
Okay, let's see. Well, I'll go first, and I'll describe you, Scott, and then you could describe me.
Oh, I'm uncomfortable already.
Yeah, I want to make it weird and complicated.
That's what we like here on Forward Thinking. You're fitting in fine already.
We host a show called Car Stuff, wherein we cover everything that floats, flies, or drives. And earlier, you guys had talked to us off the air because you are covering something that is of particular interest to us. Right, Scott?
Yeah, that's right. We're going to talk about, among other things, we're going to talk about the Volkswagen recall and the possibility of manufacturers toying with the electronics in our vehicles to more than just shutting off emissions controls.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit more devious, a little more manipulative than that.
And this is actually going to be a two-part episode that we do with our guests, Ben and Scott. And so they will be around with us next time to continue this discussion. But the broad topic that we're going to address is how the Internet of Things is going to be affecting vehicles. We've talked on the show a lot about the best ways that it might, you know, the ways computers in cars can help make us safer, can improve the performance of cars. But what about the other side? There's the possibility that the cars of the future might be a little too smart for their own good. They might be smarter than we'd like them to be, smart enough to have hidden agendas. Could your car have a hidden agenda? That's what we want to talk about today.
Also, full disclosure here, as you guys probably know, assuming that you listened to the first 4 seconds of this podcast, we are sponsored by Toyota, but they give us free rein to create this podcast, you know, from ideation straight up through editing the final product. And, you know, we're going to be talking about one of their competitors, a very large competitor of theirs in the world market is Volkswagen. But our statements here are entirely our own, and we will, as always, work to be as unbiased as possible.
Right.
And this factors in other companies aside just from VW.
So. Oh, right. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Ultimately, it's going to be a broader discussion, but we just wanted to let you know they didn't ask us to talk about this.
And yes. No,
we're
not
just
all.
Trying to pick on Volkswagen.
No.
I love the hidden agenda stuff. Just for the record, this ties into another show that I do, and I'm thrilled to be here. So thanks for having us.
What is that other show you do, Ben?
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, which Scott, you have appeared on before, and actually you two have also appeared on before, Joe and Lauren. That's it.
Separately. Not
separately.
Together.
Well, to my knowledge, I don't know.
The separation surgery has gone very well, so yes.
It was just, I
for
didn't know.
You, maybe.
I didn't know how to bring it up. So this VW emissions scandal, what is it? What makes it a scandal?
Yeah, well, this has something interesting to say about the role that computer technology plays in the cars we have today. So here's the basic story, and I know Scott and Ben, you guys will have a lot more to say about this than I will, so feel free to inject as we go along.
Will do.
But the basic idea is that in September 2015, it was revealed to the public, I believe through an announcement from the EPA, that many diesel-powered vehicles, or so-called clean diesel cars, manufactured by Volkswagen over the years, I think since 2009 until this year, 2015, have gone to market, were bought, and are currently being driven with a defeat device, that's what they've been calling it, designed specifically to cheat at emissions testing. And one note is that the story is still developing as we record this. Some new information may come to light or may change things after we record this episode, but we're going to try to be as accurate as possible for what we know today.
As of October 1st, 2015, these are the facts.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about maybe some possible fixes, what they're what they're considering doing. But right now it's all speculation at this point because we won't know for at least another week what the tentative plan is and whether or not that plan will be accepted even.
So why would you design a device inside a car to cheat at emissions testing? Essentially, I think it's that when you design a car, when you're engineering really any kind of machine, you've often got really important concerns in conflict. And in this case, the concerns in conflict or in tension were performance and environmental friendliness.
Yeah, that's right. And in the marketplace, VW was really quick to say, we've got these clean diesel. They call, you know, you've heard the term clean diesel over and over again, right? Right. And this is the important part. And we have to kind of step back and look at it this way. They were doing it so well back then, you know, back in 2008, 2009, that the other manufacturers were thinking, how are they doing this? How are they getting everything that we're trying to get out of our diesels, but we can't? How are they successful at doing that? And they thought, well, they've been doing it over in Europe for so long. Maybe that's it. Maybe they just have these in-house secrets that they know how to do this. And people look at them and kind of reverse engineer them and try to figure out how it all works. But it turns out it was this defeat software that was causing them to, you know, allow three things that, it's like a balancing act. It's fuel economy. It's emissions and performance. And, you know, the consumers, they care about maybe two of those three.
Right.
They care about fuel economy. Well, yeah, fuel economy and performance, because they want a car that's fun to drive.
Sure.
And I know people also want to do the right thing and they want to, you know, have a clean vehicle. Sure. But if they can get that out of a diesel vehicle that, you know, is more efficient, I guess, than a gasoline car typically, you know, they're going to go for that. They're going to go for that option. And VW was gaming the system by saying, like, you can have all three in our car, whereas with the other guys, you can't do that.
And to clarify for the people who might not be familiar with the benefits of gas burning versus diesel, traditionally with a diesel car, your main benefit is fuel economy, right?
Sure. Well, there's a few. You know, I can tell you three points, like pros, cons, if you want to, about diesel.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so the pros of diesel, and I'm having to refer to my notes, I'm not a diesel driver, but typically, they have high build quality. They're built really, really strong. And the reason is because there's a lot of high pressure involved.
Right. They're more durable.
Yeah, much more durable. So they're a well-built engine, typically better built than a gasoline engine would be. And they also have better fuel economy, as we said, you know, because it's just a more efficient way to do it.
It's the fuel diesel itself is more energy efficient than gasoline when you burn it. I read a statistic that said that you get like 30% better mileage per gallon about on diesel.
That sounds about right. Yeah. And but that's all playing with that that balance of performance, fuel economy, and emissions. And the last pro that I'll mention here is there's lots of torque. So, you know, at the low end, these cars are a lot of fun to drive, you know, when you're accelerating from the light or whatever. They're a thrill. And and if you use it in a heavy duty application like a truck or something, it's great for towing. It's great for pulling stumps out of the ground, you know, that kind of thing.
Would it be good for getting out of the snow?
Yeah, exactly. Good for getting out of the snow. That's right. So the cons on the other side, I'll just give you three quick ones so that we can kind of get that out there.
Mm-hmm.
Fuel typically costs more. It's like a dollar more per gallon when you go to the pumps. That's fluctuates tremendously, depending on what's
going
on. Or
a euro more, because if we're talking about diesel, the majority of those cars are going to be in the European market.
True. Mm-hmm. That's right. So also there's the higher cost of emission component maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
So you have more underneath the vehicle and part of the fuel system and part of the exhaust system, and that's really what we're getting at with this podcast. And then the last one really is that they're expensive to purchase initially. So you're going to pay more for a diesel-powered vehicle at the showroom than you're going to pay for the gasoline counterpart.
Yeah, and also a distinction between gas-powered vehicles and diesel vehicles is when they're releasing pollutants into the atmosphere, you're typically getting different kinds of pollutants, right?
Correct.
So with a gas-powered car, you're going to get a lot more carbon emissions. But with a diesel-powered car, you're going to be entering the territory of nitrogen oxides, right? The NOx emissions.
Yes, exactly. And that's critical in when you start talking about, you know, the components that I was talking about in the exhaust system.
Right.
So this is going to wrap into the fix as well, which I don't know if we're ready to talk about that yet or not, but typically on a diesel-powered vehicle, you'll have a lot of what they call exhaust scrubbers after the exhaust leaves the engine and before it gets to the tailpipe. Yeah, that's right. Gets a sponge and cleans off every little bit.
Now, those little scrubbing bubbles get in there and do a little dance.
You know, these cars, I mean, I don't know how far we want to go with this right now, but, you know, VW did install what they call lean nitrogen traps or nitrogen oxide traps, and those are on the early 2-liter TDI engines. And then later, in about 2012, and this is critical for the fix later that we'll talk about, but later in 2012, They had a more sophisticated system that is called selective catalytic reduction, or SCR systems. And we can talk about that in a little while. But you get the idea that there's more to break underneath, more to maintain, more to kind of, if you're the manufacturer, more to toy with.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, we should get back to the specific story about Volkswagen, I guess. Mm-hmm. So what exactly happened with these defeat devices in the car? Many of these vehicles, like we said, were shipped to market in a condition where the car could be environmentally friendly, meaning low emissions of harmful gases. In this case, we're talking primarily about nitrogen oxides, or NOx. Or it could have good driving performance and better fuel economy and better engine life.
Sure. Back to that balance.
But not both at the same time. You could essentially flip a switch inside the engine to decide at any given time which one you wanted to highlight.
So, yeah, the idea was that the software would determine when the vehicle was in for testing, for emissions testing.
Right.
And it would be able to – I mean, it did that via a lot of parameters that this thing was reading. So the car is kind of aware of where it is. It's reading where it is. It's deciding that I'm in a situation where someone's checking the tailpipe emissions of this vehicle right now. I'm going to alter that. I'm going to alter what I do in order to make it meet those standards. But then once we leave this test bay, I'm going to go back to being the fun, performing, you know, good fuel economy vehicle that I was before I pulled into this bay.
So we gave those cars two conflicting personalities.
Yeah,
it's
that's
the
it.
Good kid while the teacher's looking.
Right.
That's a good way to put it. That's right, yeah.
And there's another factor that we should mention here, which would be a motivation for Volkswagen's decision in this regard, and that is the evolving standards for emissions, like government regulation of this.
Yeah, which are posted way ahead of time. So they know that in 2020 they've got to meet you know, X set of standards, and then it goes up from there, and they're very aggressive.
But also that's a Herculean feat to try to change the emission standards of an entire line
fleet,
of vehicles.
Yeah.
It sure is. And, you know,
it's a feat for a fleet.
When you look back at all this, though, I mean, and now we can do that with, you know, 2020 vision, right? When we look back and see that here's Volkswagen saying we've got clean diesel cars that people love to drive because they're fun, they're fuel economy, or they've got great fuel efficiency, rather, and they meet emissions. They're great cars.
You can have it all.
Yeah, exactly. Because the other manufacturers are looking at what Volkswagen does, and they're saying, "Well, how are they doing this? We're trying.
Right.
We're getting close, but we don't have the grasp on this market like VW has.
It seems like it's magic or some kind of trick.
Are they wizards? Are they geniuses? Are they cheating? And while we're asking questions, how far off were these emissions? Like, what's the matter of degree here?
Oh, it's pretty nasty. I had read in one report at least that the NOx emissions were maybe 10 times to 40 times above what they were supposed to be.
40 times.
Yeah.
The allowed amount.
And there are about 11 million of these cars on the road worldwide. The Guardian estimated that the fleet could have contributed up to 948,691 metric tons of nitrogen oxide emissions every year since 2006, which, if it helps, is a little bit over 2 billion pounds, although I'm not sure personally if 2 billion pounds is an easier number for anyone to grasp than.
You know, the numbers in this whole thing are just staggering, aren't they? When they start talking about the amounts that they're going to fine VW, you know, the EPA can fine them.
Yeah,
I think it's 37,500 per vehicle, which in a lot of cases, that's more than the car cost new.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, just the, okay, it's 500,000 vehicles, 482,000 be precise, I think.
In the United States.
In the United States. But the numbers come out to billions of dollars. Now, even if they're going to do these fixes that we're going to talk about in a while, some are easy, some are difficult, and that, you know, greatly varies the amount that this thing could cost Volkswagen. And maybe, can I just talk for 3 minutes about something here?
Oh, yeah.
This is maybe one of the biggest blows to diesel's reputation here in the United States that they've had for 30 or 40 years.
I would say more than that, Scott.
Maybe. And it's this can't be understated enough or overstated enough.
Mm-hmm.
which way is that? What's the old saying?
This can't be overstated.
That's it. Yeah, this can't be overstated enough. Sorry.
Well, and diesel is already a really small market, right? I think it's under 1% of the overall U.S. car market.
Exactly right. And I'll tell you why that is, because a lot of people, you know, look at what we're doing here and they kind of scratch their heads like, well, Europe's been doing diesel for a long, long time. Why is it so popular there and not here in the States? If you go back to the late 1970s and the early 1980s, General Motors made a critical mistake here. They built a bunch of V8 diesel engines that they put into their Oldsmobile cars, and I don't know everything that it was put into, but a lot of the Oldsmobiles had these great big old V8 engines that were diesel-powered that were every stereotype of diesel, you know, that you can have.
Super slow acceleration.
Yeah, they were loud. You know that knocking sound that they make. You know, like a truck idling. Mm-hmm. They were loud. They had they were just belching clouds of black smoke everywhere.
They were
dirty. They were difficult to work on. And I think I heard somewhere, and I didn't read a lot about this, but they said that the technicians weren't necessarily given the proper training to repair them because they weren't diesel technicians.
Uh-huh.
So. They got then a further bad reputation for being engines that were, not only difficult to work on, but that they were, General Motors didn't know how to fix their own engines is the crux of this whole thing. And that really was just like a death blow for diesel in the United States. It just didn't work out after that point. And now here's the scam now.
Well, here's a bigger problem though too, because this ties into something that we'll see later on in the podcast, spoiler alert, is that when early adoption technologies are, you know, I don't want to say in their infancy, but early into their popularization, if something goes wrong, if one thing goes wrong, then it's very often a death blow. And that's what happened with diesel
V8s. Yeah, sure. But okay, to argue the other side, diesel had been around for 100 years at that point.
Yeah, that's why I changed it to popularize,
but you know what I mean,
though.
Okay, popularize. You're right. So it just has never caught on here. It's just never been the way we do it.
Basically because they poisoned the well, you're saying.
That's true.
Yeah,
and, you know, a lot of people still remember that. And people who owned those vehicles would never buy another diesel. And family members, if they talked to, friends, whatever, they had a terrible association with diesel-powered cars from that situation, I guess we'll call it, you know, back in the late 70s, early 80s.
Well, that's really interesting. But one thing that I want to bring us back to is something you were talking about when we were talking about the specifics of the defeat devices in the Volkswagen vehicles, because when you look at what these devices had to do in order to know when to switch on the good behavior mode, they had to look at a lot of different conditions, right? They looked at how the steering wheel was being used,
right,
and different conditions that you would have to have been very sensitive to in order to know that it's time to be on your good behavior. Essentially, what I'm getting at is that this was very obviously intentionally programmed to cheat. There's no way you can pretend it was an accident.
No, you can't accidentally write crib notes.
Yeah, the software engineer who developed all this knew what was going on, and not just the one person. This is way bigger than that. I mean, there's so many checks and balances in building a vehicle like this and getting the software or getting it programmed correctly. There's again, like you said, there's no way that this was not intentional.
Oh, can I do it? You guys, this goes all the way to the top.
But the thing this is going to bring us to eventually on this topic is the role of software design in governing our machines as a whole, but specifically today our vehicles. But we do want to acknowledge at first that this is not necessarily always going to be a specific intentional program designed to cheat, because there are a lot of situations where real world performance is different than lab performance.
Emissions testing is by no means a perfect science.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this thing that we run into on car stuff pretty often, and anybody who has ever purchased a car has unfortunate knowledge about this phenomenon, which is the MPG that you see on the sticker is rarely, if ever, the MPG that you see in your day-to-day driving. And that's partially because, going back to the earlier point about lab tests, there are so many small intervening variables that simply cannot be accounted for. So this doesn't just go into efficiency, this also goes into emissions, right? So you can see that it's not, you know, I know it sounds like we're picking on VW, and we're just saying what they did, but it's not just VW, right? Mercedes also has some issues with this, as well as BMW, Peugeot, and they, in some reports, they're swallowing around 50% more fuel than their lab tests say they should.
Wow.
So you're buying a car, and there are a lot of misconceptions about efficiency, and I hope, ladies and gentlemen, you can hear my air quotes around efficiency. But there are a lot of misconceptions about how much it actually matters and what does this percentage mean to me when the rubber hits the road. What we do know is that these tests are vulnerable to various manipulations that could be completely accidental. And again, they don't really reflect what's actually going to happen when you're driving Mercedes A, a C, an E class, BMW 5, Peugeot 308. They're all way off in terms of their actual performance versus their lab stuff. And I'm not saying that they're cheating. It doesn't mean that they also have some sort of pernicious defeat device, but it does mean that our methodology is probably not as sound as it could be.
No, and there's a little side note here that I feel like I need to make. But in the early 1990s, outside of Michigan, I was in a city that had to have emissions testing, you know, and they used a probe that they would put up the tailpipe of the vehicle while they, you know, ran it through the revs and, you know, did everything they had to do. My car failed one year. And it was a shock to me, and I thought, oh, my gosh, I'm going to have to go through expensive repairs, you know, and then I don't even know if that'll make the change,
right,
you know, make it legal, make it fit.
It could be a gas cap. It could be a catalytic converter.
The guy says, don't worry, and he deletes the last test and says that he's going to run a second test on the vehicle, which is allowed. You're allowed to do a second test.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And he holds the probe that's supposed to go in the tailpipe about 6 feet away from the exhaust. And of course, the car passes with flying colors. And I mean, so there can be cheating on several different levels.
Wait, we need to let the manufacturers in on this technology. You just measure in a different place.
Right.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, it's very
smart. We could save the planet.
Bribery.
It's real
terrific
smart.
Technology.
Yeah, but doesn't it give you a good feeling?
Oh, you didn't bribe him, though. That was just a freebie.
No, it was a freebie. Yeah, he was just doing that out of the kindness of his own heart. But I mean, it opens your eyes that, you know, well, maybe things aren't always the way they seem.
Which car was it?
Boy, let's see. That must have been a you know what? That was probably a Lynx station wagon.
The
Mercury Lynx station wagon.
Yeah.
It was brown.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, it was. Of course it was.
Yeah. Yep.
Some rust coloration.
Yeah, no. It was a good shape. Really good shape. I bought that car for $1. From
nice.
A friend's father, yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yep.
That's
yeah.
like something straight out of the Wonder Years.
Yeah.
We need photographic evidence.
You know what? I do have photographic evidence.
Yes.
There's a photo of me shaking the hands with the guy and a dollar being exchanged. It was a friend's father. It was just kind of a corny photo.
Uh-huh.
But I've got some great photos of the car. It's a good
that,
condition.
That too. Yeah. That sounds beautiful.
You'd think a dollar would be a pile of crap, but it's not.
Folks at home, look out for our image gallery on the site of Scott buying a car for $1 through various layers of Google Deep Dream.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to have to go dig through some boxes in the basement and find that photo.
Yeah. I'm sure we can put it up and people will check it out because people love the pictures of the cars. You know?
Yeah. Right. In the meanwile,
we got to get back to the topic.
Yeah, sorry, guys. We've been hanging out.
Oh, no, it's okay. It's like coffee talk, but with cars.
Right.
So I read about a possible solution to some of these problems with emission tests being sensors being fit into exhaust systems and running as cars are on the road at, you know, just whenever someone wants to check up on it.
So like constant real-time monitoring.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's something that is technologically possible.
Well, simply a software tweak, right?
Yeah.
I think that
is how they actually detected it in this case, right? They hired these independent researchers to investigate it, and so they drove the car around with the probe up the tailpipe.
Sure,
right?
Get it out of the lab and see how it performs in real life. Because that lab situation is a fake situation, really. I mean, and that's the thing is they knew exactly the conditions that vehicle would be exposed to, you know, during testing, and that's how they did it. They said when this happens, this will happen, and when this happens, this will happen, and it's very logical how they all laid it out. I mean, it's very smart. It's very clever.
Decision tree, right?
Yeah, it's just a matter of looking at all the data and making a smart decision that, hey, I mean, it's a devious decision.
Well,
it's in the lab, so make it meet these standards.
But in defense of the lab stuff in general, I'm not saying what they do is crude or dumb or just flat out wrong. They're doing the best they can. As a matter of fact, favorite piece of, since we are officially in Halloween month, favorite piece of car testing trivia is about the crash test dummies.
Oh,
remember that one,
yes,
Scott?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, do you want to do the honor?
I guess so. I mean, it's no secret, really. manufacturers sometimes would use cadavers for crash test dummies.
Yeah, that's how much the realism matters.
Yeah, yeah.
So I mentioned that halfway because it's Halloween, and for the other half because it does show that these people are working hard. It just means that VW worked even more assiduously to outsmart them.
That's the way it is, isn't it? It's always like a cat and mouse game.
Now, yeah. I have a question. I'm wondering if our, what would you call it, our performance reporting is getting more accurate over time. Like, when you buy a car and it says, oh, it gets this MPG, it emits this much, is that more true than it used to be or less true?
Well, it's tough to use a broad brush on that one because it can vary case by case. And as it, you know, or model by model, there are some cars that are known for being wildly inaccurate, you know, even in their most optimistic. And then there's also the age and the maintenance record of a car that could affect it, especially if it's been driving for a few years.
Just a few years ago, wasn't there a major reconstruction of the way that they met mm-hmm. the way they reached those numbers? And I don't, yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't know we were going to go here, but I don't have the date in front of me, but it was while I was working here, I believe.
Yeah.
That they decided that the way we test cars is no longer accurate. We need to do it a different way. And it adjusted every vehicle that they had in this big database. It adjusted every single reading that they had on them, as far as, you know, like what they got in the city, what they got on the highway. And it was all based on, a new set of test parameters that they had for them, like more like a real-world situation.
Right, trying to address this gap in testing results and actual performance. So the problem is that in 2001, the gap between actual performance and test results was about 8%, right? 8% discrepancy. This rose in 2014 to about 40% on average, which is, you know, bad.
But, and a big increase in a short period of time.
Right, yeah. So what they found is that there were – it's similar to, I guess, the relationship between race car teams and race car regulatory bodies, because the rules on – race car teams are pretty strict, right? But there are all these little loopholes you can use to get around them, right? Where you're not quite breaking the rules, but you're making them practice yoga.
Yeah, well, it's like fairy logic all the time. Like as, right. as long as you kind of just say not entirely the truth, as long as you don't outright lie, you're telling the truth.
But according to various sources, this gap without any action would grow to as high as 50% on average by 2020. So there is a definite and systemic problem here. Legislators, regulators are trying to address it, but it's VW is just the most extreme and illegal example of a gray area practice.
But Scott, you said earlier that there was a fix that VW was potentially working on.
Well, you know, we're still about a week away from really understanding exactly what they're going to do. And my initial thought on this whole thing was that it was just going to be a quick software change. You know, that's you just simply
sure.
What you do is you would just make it seem like it's in test mode all the time, and just it's a quick thing to do. You pull into the dealership, and it takes a few minutes maybe, and that's it. You're done.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like there's going to be quite a bit more to do than just that. It's not that simple. And I think part of the reason, well, I know part of the reason is that if you do that, it's going to make the cars basically undrivable. They're going to be, because trying to get that low level of emissions is going to be so restrictive on the cars that they're not going to perform in the real world like they normally would. And I'm sure that that's what the, those outside testing agencies found when they, drove around town with the probe up the tailpipe there of the vehicle. And, realize that it's not something that somebody would, want to drive after, at that point. So I think that Volkswagen is looking at some hardware, changes, some switchovers, and that's going to be incredibly expensive. I don't even know. I mean, you can't really put a number on it yet because you don't know exactly what they're going to do. And then how are they going to do it in a short amount of time, too? Because you can't just throw parts at this problem that don't really go on that vehicle anyways. You can't say, well, we've got this that works on this vehicle, we'll put it on here. You have to re-engineer this whole thing so that it operates correctly in the system.
For what did you say, Lauren, 11 million vehicles?
Worldwide, yeah.
11 million, and that's about 500,000 here. So yeah. A very small amount. As you said, it was, what, 1%?
Less than 1%, I think, of the United States are diesel vehicles.
Yeah, and that's all diesel vehicles, not just
VWs. Yeah, so, yeah. And Audi. Audi, too, at least in the United States, has some of the – it's a particular four-cylinder engine
system that they use. Yeah, the Audi A3, I think, from 09 to 15 is affected in this as well. So just one of their models in the United States anyways. But that's the thing is that, you know, once they do fix this with whatever they do, you know, whatever parts they do throw at it, is the customer going to want to still drive that vehicle because it's not going to perform the way it did when they bought it? It's like they were – well, they're sold a lie, really. I mean, that's right. What it is. A lot of people are saying that phrase. They're saying, I was sold a lie by Volkswagen. And, you know, once they fix this, am I going to want it? And is anybody else going to want to buy it back from me as well? I mean, this hurts resale value, too.
Yeah, people aren't going to want to buy
this. This is so damaging to Volkswagen's reputation. It's unbelievable what this is going to do to them. I can tell you a couple of, like, things that are possible, maybe. You know, the... just switching on to software, that's not going to really do it. So I mentioned earlier that some of the early 2-liter TDI engines from back in, it would have been late 2008, but in 2009 model year cars, the ones that are first affected by this whole thing, you know, the Golf, the Jetta, the Beetle, and the Audi that we just mentioned.
Scott, sorry, what does TDI stand for?
Oh, turbo. Turbo direct injection, or you know, a lot of people just say turbo diesel.
Right, because it's for turbo diesel engines.
Yeah, yeah, but direct injection is a specific type of injection for this engine. But,
okay, please continue.
Okay, all right. So these early engines, I mean, it's possible that software that I just said, you know, they could make the switch on it. That's a possibility for those early cars. The ones that were built after 2012, and again, you know, the early ones. Who's going to want to drive it? Because it's going to be in test mode all the time. It's going to be very difficult. So I think they're going to find a hardware solution around that. But the ones that were built after 2012 or in 2012, that more sophisticated system, the selective catalytic reduction system, or SCR, that uses a liquid urea solution that's injected into the system that further burns down the nitrogen oxides that are in the particulate filter. So it's reducing all the soot and garbage that comes out of the engine after it's burned. And if they retrofit cars with that, if they have to put a system like that in, then that's going to be super expensive because, I mean, it's adding an entire new system that, you know, is on some of the bigger vehicles. I think they put that on the Passat and I don't know. It's also going to require more maintenance if they do it that way because even the ones that have it right now, they have to go in every 10,000 miles and have that urea replenished and the system cleaned out. So they're going to they say that, you know, if these new vehicles are the ones that get this system, you know, retrofitted to them, I guess, if that's the way they do it, they're going to require it every 5,000 miles. So this becomes, you know, a difficult thing for a car owner to have to do. I mean, every 5,000 miles, they have to go back to the dealership to have this this serviced in some way.
Add to that, the manufacturer has to be the one paying for that service.
Oh, yeah.
Every time.
Yeah, that's right. You're right, exactly. And it just becomes a huge, huge headache for Volkswagen and its owners. So I hope they get this all straightened out and figure out what they're going to do soon. And it's something that's agreeable to everybody.
Yeah, because on a personal note, I love Volkswagen. I think they're cool.
I drive a Volkswagen.
Yeah.
Yeah, not a diesel, though.
Not a diesel.
Yeah, well, ultimately, I think this is just an interesting case. I mean, it's interesting to us for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's going to lead us to talking about how the Internet of Things affects cars and smart cars, which we're going to get more into next time.
Yeah, and the future of computerization of cars.
Yeah, but also it does just bring us back to this engineering problem that we started with. Whenever you design a machine, you've got forces that are in tension, you know, concerns that you have to juggle. What are you going to prioritize? And I do think it's inspiring to me to think about all of the engineers who are working earnestly on this problem to solve it, to make great cars that still don't harm the environment as much as they used to.
That are fun to drive and perform well.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing about something at this level of sophistication is that it's always going to be a work in progress. For instance, there's at this point no such thing as a death-proof car, but there have been enormous strides in safety, in proactive things, not just passive measures, right? And if you think about it, emissions in a larger field kind of falls under this umbrella of safety. It's ultimately supposed to be safety for everyone.
The reason that all of this emission stuff is so important is that it really does have a very large impact on air pollution, leading to both climate change and to poor health for a whole lot of people, especially around cities. It's estimated that tens of thousands of people die every year due to medical complications that are rooted in this kind of air pollution. And nitrogen oxides in particular lead to a lot of smog and air pollution.
Yeah. Everybody needs air. I mean, we've all got a stake in fighting smog.
Yeah, yeah. This delicious soup that surrounds us is pretty important.
I've been using air through this whole podcast.
What?
Really?
Yes.
I knew it.
Official endorsement of air from Scott Benjamin?
Been juicing.
Yeah, I do. I like air.
Do your air commercial right now.
I don't know if I have an air commercial, but air, breathe it.
The proceeding is not a paid endorsement by Scott Benjamin. Be warned that air may have the following side effects: lightheadedness, dizziness, jubilation. Scott Benjamin and Forward Thinking assume no responsibility for any injuries or liabilities incurred through the use of air.
Did you say jubilation?
Thanks, Ben.
Well, here at
it's
Forward
nice
Thinking,
the whole thing.
We love jubilation, but we also love hearing from you. So this is going to conclude part one of this two-part episode, but if you want to come back and join us next time, we're going to talk about the future implications that emerge from this problem we observed with this cheating software and what it means for the smart cars of the future. We know they can be smart and help us, but what should we be wary about?
All right, I like it.
So if you would like to get in touch with us, you can email us at fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. You can visit our website at fwthinking.com. You can go to our Facebook or Twitter feeds. Their names are basically FW Thinking. And Scott and Ben, if people want to listen to your show and hear more from you, how can they get a hold of you?
Well, we're CarStuffHSW on Facebook and Twitter. And you can go to CarStuffShow.com and see our website where we have all of our podcasts. And that's kind of the archive of everything. Or you can send us an email at CarStuff@HowStuffWorks.com.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. We hope to hear from you. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.